From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. IndyMac Bancorp reopens today under federal management. The mortgage lender was taken over on Friday after worried customers made a run on their bank's deposits. And IndyMac wasn't the only company thrown a federal lifeline this weekend. The U.S. Treasury is taking major steps to rescue America's two largest mortgage finance companies, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. So how does all of this affect the wealth building of black families? In just a few minutes, we'll be speaking with columnist and author Kai Wright about the subprime swindle. That's what he calls it. Kai writes at TheRoot.com and is also author of the book Drifting Towards Love, Black, Brown, Gay, and Coming of Age on the Streets of New York. But right now we have our News and Notes economist Keith Reed. He's a business reporter for the Cincinnati Inquirer and blogs for BET's finance page, Dollar Out of 15 Cents. Hey, Keith.
Hey, Farah, how you doing?
I'm doing great. So, IndyMac, what happened? First of all, how significant is this company?
It's very significant. This is the second largest financial institution in U.S. history to close. Just to give you an idea of scope, there's only ever been one other bank larger than IndyMac to have had to close under the type of duress that IndyMac did. So it is a pretty significant bank. And some members of the audience may be wondering, why do I care if I didn't have any money with this bank? Because our financial system is such that when one thing happens with a big institution, it affects many other institutions, because all of these banks lend to each other overnight. Many of these banks, the shareholders of these banks get nervous. So the shareholder of another bank, maybe a larger bank, looks at IndyMac and says, oh my God, I'm worried about this. That bank is in the same business that my company is in. So they start selling shares, market value plunges. I mean, you get to a point where so many things are tied together that any one failure could topple conceivably the entire system if it's big enough. That didn't happen in this case, but it is significant.
What about federal insurance? What kind of protection does the federal government offer to the people who are invested in this bank?
Well, to investors in the bank, it doesn't really offer any protection. If you are a depositor, of course, there's the FDIC insurance. You see that big sticker when you walk into any bank branch that says your deposits are insured up to $100,000 by the federal government. That's what the Federal Deposit Insurance Corp does for banks. But if you're an investor, you're stuck. I mean, if you have shares in a company, that's the risk that you take. This is the downside of investing. You put your money into a company. Those shares are worth $20 when you buy them. If they drop to $5, you're out. If they go up to $25 a share, then you made a $5 share profit. But if the company fails, there is no protection for you, at least not from the federal government.
Do you think that a company like this, shares might end up in, say, 401ks and people's retirement plans?
It's possible. I mean, you would have to really look closely at what's in your 401k. Many people in their 401ks have funds, or even funds of funds. You know, their companies will put together a portfolio, and many times you'll go and look at your 401k and they'll say, okay, choose this portfolio if you're going to retire in 2030. Choose this portfolio if you're going to retire 10 years from now. And what you really have to do is look at the prospectus for those funds that you have in your 401k to be able to figure out what your 401k's holdings are. If you are in a 401, my guess is that most 401ks tend to be so diversified that one company, one bank's failure is not going to be too heavily weighted in your own personal account that it's going to affect your retirement. So nobody should worry there. The bigger problem, again, comes in if this becomes a broader issue for financial stocks and your 401k is holding a good deal of those. Might be a good time to check, but I don't think an individual holder of a 401k retirement account really has anything to worry about from this.
So let's go back to the issue of people who are depositing. Remind us again how much the limit is for full coverage from the federal government, and then what happens when you've reached that limit?
It's $100,000, and after $100,000, it's a good idea for you to be diversified in where you have your money. I mean, in most cases, you're not going to have somebody with $100,000 cash or more than $100,000 cash sitting in one particular checking account. And many banks, most financial institutions are going to have different options for you beyond just those deposits. But for the federal insurance limits, it's up to $100,000, and then after that, the insurance is gone, and you're not necessarily covered, which is why one of the reasons why you're told that if you have a large amount of cash, you want to look at diversifying, doing different things with the money as opposed to keeping it all sitting in one place.
I want to bring in Kai Wright now. He's a columnist and recently had a cover article for The Nation titled "The Subprime Swindle: How Banks Stole Black America's Hard-Won Wealth and Gambled It Away in Risky Investment Schemes." You can also find an article on the website The Root, and it's on the front page when I went to look at it today. You talk about your own mother having to give up her house. Tell me about that.
Well, I mean, I think one of the significant things there is it's similar to the family I profiled and a number of the families I interviewed when I went down to Atlanta. Is there's a lot of shame, you know. There's this belief that that you know you have done something wrong, and now you're in this position, and so what that means is that folks end up waiting too long, beating their heads against brick walls for too long. Before they get around to asking for help from either other family members or from a variety of sort of nonprofits that are out there trying to help them, or even trying to engage the lender to say, hey, listen, this is a bad deal I got, and what are we going to do about it before it gets to be too late? So it's not until it gets to be too late that folks start talking about it. That was the same thing that happened with my mom. That's the same thing that happened with the family I profiled. They got themselves into these situations, or got drawn into these situations, I would argue, and then hid it from everybody in their lives until the last minute.
You profiled an older gentleman who kind of got into a cycle of just, it's like the cartoons of the snowball becoming the avalanche. Tell me what happened to him.
He's a guy, he bought his house in 1968. One of the things we hear about with this is, oh, you know, the subprimes, they did as much good as bad because they encouraged minority home ownership. We got first-time buyers in, but a very small percentage of the subprime loans since 98 actually went to first-time home buyers. He is an example of what more than half of them were refinances. He had his house since 1968. It became a very important part of the family, both for their financial security, but then also just for a wide range of stability. They owned it and borrowed responsibly against it for, you know, for 30 some odd years, and then 2003, I believe it was, they got a $68,000 refinance to put up some new siding. And in the course of 4 years, they flipped through four more refinances that landed him owing $125,000 on a house that is at an outside worth $100,000, and through a whole host of questionable practices to get him into that loan. One of the most strike, he had an IndyMac loan, and you know they did a lot of these no documentation loans. That's part of the problem they ran against, and he had one of these. Where, you know, here's a guy who's living on a Postal Service pension and Social Security, and the loan application says he makes $5,000 a month. And IndyMac told me they didn't think that was a red flag, but it seems to me anybody interested in actually underwriting these loans would have said, wait a minute here.
Keith, is that illegal, overstating income? Is there a law against it?
There is a new regulation that was just passed today that would have required the bank, IndyMac in that case, to have proof of the lender's income before making that loan. Up until now, that was completely legal, was unregulated, and you could you could do it. It is unethical. Banks have been sued for doing that. In some cases, they've been prosecuted, but you have to do a very careful prosecution because in many cases and in many states, this wasn't these mortgage lenders weren't regulated. One of the differences between IndyMac and banks in general and many of the bigger subprime players was that mortgage companies and banks are different. In other words, if you're a bank and you have that federal insurance in a charter as a bank, you have to follow federal lending regulations. If you're a mortgage lender and you're not technically a bank, you are immune and you had been immune for, you know, until now, from many of the regulations. The states didn't regulate them. The federal government didn't regulate them. And there was a flip in the percentage of mortgages that were done. It used to be that most of the mortgages were done by banks. Most mortgage lending was done by banks. And now, or at least in the last five or seven years, the majority of that lending shifted over to the mortgage companies. And so you had far more lending happening on a level where it was not regulated than you did by a bank or an institution that had federal oversight at all.
And as a result, you also had far more subprime lending related to that. And in particular in African American and Latino neighborhoods. And one of the things with this regulation conversation, one of the ways it's been framed is it was this sort of accidental vacuum, but it really was a vacuum that was exploited both by these unregulated lenders and the larger banks that own them in some cases that would have been regulated but that had these subsidiaries in order to be able to do this kind of lending. We talk about it as the exploding interest rates, and that's what we think about subprime. But it's actually a much broader category of stuff, from these no doc and low doc loans to inflated appraisals, to just the way in which the loan is made. You go into a neighborhood like the one George Mitchell lived in, and they find people like him and say, listen, hey, you've got all this equity you're wasting, and convince them, you should borrow this money. You should borrow a larger loan, borrow a larger and larger loan, of which they get no benefit whatsoever. He got $360 out of his last $125,000 loan.
Well, gentlemen, we're going to stop now, and graciously you have agreed to come back after the break. This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. We're back with an update on the housing crisis and its effect on black wealth in America. With us, Keith Reed. He's a business reporter for the Cincinnati Inquirer. He blogs for BET's finance page, Dollar Out of 15 Cents. And Kai Wright, author of The Nation article, The Subprime Swindle, How Banks Stole Black America's Hard-Won Wealth and Gambled It Away in Risky Investment Schemes. Welcome back, guys. And I'm going to move straight into another big issue. We talked a little bit about the banking side of things. Now, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac are the two largest mortgage finance companies in the country. They have over half of America's mortgages. Keith, what exactly are these two entities, and what is going on? They're in trouble right now.
Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac are interesting companies because they're private, but they are supported and backed by the U.S. government. I don't think many people ever expected them to have to reach out for the kind of backing that they're now getting. But essentially what they do is they will go out and they will back, or they will underwrite many of the mortgages that happen, so that if you're a bank and you go out and someone wants to, or a lender and someone wants to borrow money from you, it becomes easier for that bank to lend money because they know that Fannie and Freddie will purchase the mortgage from the bank. And so if you've got somebody who maybe would have been on a bubble, maybe wouldn't have qualified for the best rate, maybe wouldn't have been able to borrow the money for the house, Fannie and Freddie have been something of a safety net to the borrower, if not the mortgage industry itself, for decades.
And what's going on with them?
Well, essentially what's happening is they've got a lot of bad mortgages, just like every other lender out there right now, because they buy so many lenders. And this is one of the fundamental problems with the housing crisis and really the credit crisis. Many mortgages, as we've talked about before, were not held onto by the banks that bought them, which is why so many bad mortgages were written. If I lend you $5 and then I sell the debt to Kai, it's Kai's responsibility to come after you for the money, so I don't have to worry about you ever paying me back the $5. Well, Fannie and Freddie are in the business of guaranteeing mortgages, so the banks can make many mortgages, can make all these loans that they don't have to worry about. Well, Fannie and Freddie are the ones who, at the end of the day, end up holding on to the paper, what's called the paper, which is the note that guarantees that mortgage. With so many people in default and people falling behind, and the economy being what it is, They just ran into liquidity problems like many other banks are running into liquidity problems, and they needed not so much a bailout, but they needed an extension of credit.
All right, Kai, I want to return to what this means for Black America. When you have these major issues of turbulence and shifts in the financial world, what does it mean for the wealth of Black families and intergenerational wealth, for example?
Well, I mean, this is the thing. There's so many different echo effects from this that are particularly felt particularly hard in Black America. So at the sort of familial level, there's, you know, home equity is such an outsized proportion of what Black wealth exists. There's a huge wealth gap in America in the first instance. But to the degree that it gets closed is through home equity. When you remove, I believe the stat is if once you remove home equity from the wealth equation, Blacks own about a percentage of the wealth of their white counterparts. You know, so it's such a big important part of what wealth status we have. And you know, you look at a family again like the Mitchells. You know, they had this house for a generation. It would have been something that, as George went into the end of his life, was something that his children, his middle-aged children, would have inherited, would have been some capital that they could have used. And instead, it's they are using their money now to try to support that. So not only do they not get the inheritance, they have to then take what resources they do have, take their wealth, and flow it backwards to try to shore up to keep George in his house. On the familial level, it really limits that sort of generation to generation movement that you see in other communities.
Let me just say very briefly, and I know that you were going to go into some other aspects, but we have to wrap this up. Keith first, and then Kai. Do you think that as a whole we could end up with African Americans in terms of wealth being worse off compared to white Americans in, say, 10 or 15 years?
I don't think that's a question. I mean, unless something dramatic were to happen, you have to look at how far back as a whole African Americans are compared to the rest of the population, particularly compared to white Americans in terms of wealth. The gap is enormous. And unless something drastic happens, I don't expect it to be closed in the next 10 or 15 years. Now, there could be some momentum made, but to the extent that momentum begins to shift is going to depend on when the financial markets, when the housing markets, when employment, when all of the things that enable a person or a community to gain wealth begin to turn around. And I don't see that happening, honestly, in the next anywhere near before the next 12 or maybe even 18 months.
Yeah, I mean,
Kai, do you think that there should be some kind of collective action from African-American groups, and who might those be, or is everybody on their own?
Well, I mean, you know, the bottom line is without a large-scale public investment, we are going to see a widening of the gap. I mean, there will be a net loss in Black homeownership between the beginning of subprime and now. So we will have lost ground in homeownership. Two, with the disproportionate impact of these foreclosures on Black neighborhoods, you have all of these empty properties sitting in Black neighborhoods, returning these areas that were up and coming in many cases, that we had spent years investing in to try to undo the losses of the 80s. That's all going to be reversed without some sort of massive public investment to do something with those properties and to get people out of these bad loans.
All right, Keith, Kai, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Keith Reed is a reporter for the Cincinnati Inquirer, and he blogs for BET's finance page, Dollar Out of 15 Cents. He joined us from member station WVXU in Cincinnati, Ohio. Kai Wright is an editor, columnist, and author. He's author of the new book, Drifting Towards Love, Black, Brown, Gay, and Coming of Age in the Streets of New York.